Do you want to hop into diving?
Yeah. Talk about diving.
So you kind of explained why you got into diving. You got your license, when was it, 2017 or 2018? But then what really drew you into it, and what actually about diving do you really love?
Cool. What drew me into it was partly just the fact that, scuba diving is like nothing you will have ever done before. And I don't mean that in the sense of to intimidate anybody or to make you feel inadequate or anything. But when you accept that it is that you have no prerequisite knowledge of what you're about to do, that's how you get through it. And that's how you make it become easy. Because the biggest problem for people who have trouble learning how to dive, me being one of them, is you have a kind of fundamental misunderstanding of the property of water. And you try and basically act like you would on land in water, and that doesn't work in water because water is completely different, and momentum travels differently in water, and movements look different in water, and the way you move has to be conducted in a different way in the water. And the crazy thing for a lot of people that they don't understand right off the bat is that you control your position in the water with your breathing. So if I take a deep breath in, I'll start to go up a little bit, and if I take a deep breath out, I'll start to go down a little bit. Now I started to really love scuba diving because, it was hard, and I found it really challenging, and I was almost like, I want to fix this. I can't believe I suck at this. I can't conduct my position in the water very well. I'm flopping all the way over. I'm not comfortable. I'm feeling really panicked underwater a lot. I need to sort this out. That was part of me staying around a little bit extra longer, was because I wanted to just be a competent, comfortable diver at the end of it. But then you go to a dive site that has walls and walls of fish, and you go, wow, this diving through a wall of swimming through a wall of fish is a completely unparalleled experience to anything I've ever done in my life as well. So I've really enjoyed it that way. What really got me into it though is teaching. I liked diving. I started to really love diving when I started to teach though. And that was kind of, I guess the realizations I had about myself at the time and how I'd never been a teacher in a formal setting before. Saw the potential I had as a teacher, as a diving instructor, and just, as a person who can teach people things and present information in a clear way. That was always, something that I wanted. I mean, something you constantly work on, but when you find a new skill that you think, oh my God, I think I'm really good at this, I really enjoy it. When you really find that, I think that's how you know you're on the path, right? I've heard a few people always talk to me about the path, right? Finding those important points in your life where you realize things that are very near and true to you. And that was definitely one of them.
It's definitely a hobby that has a ton of fear associated with it as well. And kind of, how do you handle that fear? Because I know for me, I'm not a big fan of water, let alone going that deep in the water. So what are your coping mechanisms? I know you're big into meditating. Is that something you use, or is there something else you use to kind of handle that fear, or you just kind of go at it?
Good questions. Like I was talking about with work before, I mean, it's the same. It's when I was talking about listening to podcasts, reading books, and trying to prepare myself for the workday, outside of the workday. It's the same thing. It's just in a different medium. So I have to make sure that, you know, my body is always in like peak performance condition. So I do a lot of yoga to keep really, really loose so I don't cramp up under the water, things like that. Meditation is another huge one for me. Breath work, so that I can consume less air on the dives than my students, for example. Those are things that obviously not everybody does, but I personally like those things that I find that they improve my diving. And they help you cope with the fear, like you said. I don't encounter much fear underwater anymore, because I've seen quite a lot of the things that I could possibly be scared of. And I've found ways to not avoid those things and confront them and say, you know, I'm not scared of these things anymore. And so that, I guess, repetition through the action really helps with that. Where it kind of comes in with students is I really just try and build the most cooperative and open environment that they can learn from. Like when I sit down with students the first time I talk to them, I'm very clear on things like we talked about with water and the misunderstandings people have about water and things like that, and just try and keep them, make sure that they have an open mind and that I can put them in the right frame of mind so that when they hop in the water, they're going to be able to deal with things that they might be a little bit more scared of. Also, I think that we can all agree that doing things that you're really scared of is super empowering, and overcoming them is super empowering. And there's nothing more empowering for me on that job than getting somebody to get through kind of a wall of fear. And for example, like one of the biggest walls of fear people have trouble with is taking your mask off underwater. So while you're breathing from your regulator, which is the piece you breathe from that's connected to the tank, basically all the skills you do in the open water course are basically to prevent you from, or to help you understand the equipment and what can go wrong with the equipment, because it's a very equipment intense sport. So familiarizing yourself with the equipment is pretty much paramount to not being scared of it and letting it use, or I mean, I guess you using it in the right way, as opposed to it using you because you don't know how to conduct your body in it, that type of thing. So when you get people very often who don't like taking their mask off because they don't like the water on their face, and especially when you're breathing out, there's bubbles that come up. It can be pretty disorienting and pretty irritating. Also, depending on whether you close your eyes or you open them underwater, you can't see, and people don't like when they can't see, right? People also don't like when they have a mask off and they breathe a little bit through their nose by accident, because so they snort some water in. That freaks people out a lot, things like that. Personally, when I can coach somebody through that, and I can coach somebody through that 99.9% of the time, personally, when you do that, that's easily the most empowering thing that I've ever had in a job in my life. Does that answer your question?
Exactly, it does. Don't you have some sort of metaphor you use underwater to make people feel more comfortable? You want to tell that one or move on from that one?
Which one is this one?
When you have to breathe out of your nose.
Oh, that one. Oh,
yeah. You want to save that one?
Save that one. Yeah. Okay. That's a good point. There's use of metaphors and comparing things to something that somebody knows about is usually a good way of getting somebody to feel less scared about something, right?
For sure.
For example, like clearing the water out of your mask is quite a magical process, because all you need to do is breathe through your nose and look up and lift your mask off your face a little bit, and all the water just comes through. It's like watching magic happen. It's kind of hilarious. People don't believe you the first time you tell them that it's going to do that. It's things like that. Like, okay, so one of the most important things about it is that somebody's breathing out of their nose and not through their mouth, because they're not going to clear the mask if they're breathing out of their mouth. So you have to convince them, okay, you have to be able to switch between your nose and your mouth quite easily. And a good way to remember that is to think of yourself blowing your nose. So I often will be like, guys, I want you to just go down there and just straight up blow your nose in your mask before I come over to you. Just try blowing your nose. And you'll just see them like, in a really, really funny way across. And you're like, yeah, great. You sneeze or you blew your nose. Great, great, great. Perfect. And then you get them to try it and with water in their mouth, and they smash it the first time, things like that. But then obviously when you have young backpackers as your primary market of people, the metaphors and the language, obviously the metaphors and the ways of explaining things, you can do them in a bit more of a fun and kind of hilarious way. Like the way you weight belts are always one that everybody has a hilarious story about how to remember it, because the way that a weight belt works is you have to put it on, you have to make sure you have a right hand release. I don't need to get into why you need a right hand release, but if I were to have to release it fast, I need to be able to do it with my right hand. So to remember that, you always you always pick it up in your right hand and then the other half, the other side in your left hand. And the easy way to remember is because you always, there's a, you basically say the one on the clasp on the, that shuts it is the female end and the part that goes through is the male end. And everybody's like, oh yeah, funny joke. I get that. And so, and then depending on whether on your audience, you see people go, yeah. So then, people make jokes like, okay, so the male thought he was always right, so the female left. Things like that.
That's funny.
Those are super boring. Those are super boring ones. I mean, there was the funniest thing I've ever heard anybody say for a comparison was the one you were talking about. I was working with another instructor, and one of the girls was just having a little bit of trouble with her nose, breathing out of her nose. She was just like, I have so much trouble breathing out of my nose. And he goes, no, trust me, you're overthinking it. You've done it before. He goes, I don't know. When have I done, I've never done it before. I don't know. And he goes, honestly, you have to breathe out of your nose when you're sucking a dick. You've done it before.
Oh, that's good. I got it out of you.
I was waiting for the build up.
So you said,
and she got it though, right?
Yeah, right away. It's an excellent teaching right away. Method.
Oh yeah, yeah.
What are two skills that, because for tangible, like for soccer, if I'm doing the sport of soccer, I know how to kick and I know how to like catch a goalie ball. What are two like skills in diving that like you can kind of measure from diver to diver?
Breathing. Breathing is easily one. You can tell somebody who's got a good connection to their feet and somebody who doesn't. Do you know what I mean by that?
Not really, no.
Someone who's likely played sport before or has some form of experience moving their feet around their feet around and getting used to their feet being behind them and swimming around in a different way. That definitely makes a difference. And people who can breathe well make a big difference. And people who can monitor and be aware of their breathing. Instead of, at the beginning, you'll always have to say to people, okay, I want you to try and breathe in for 2 seconds and out for 4 seconds. You always want to breathe out longer than you're breathing it in. But then once that becomes ingrained, then what you can do is you can breathe just to conduct your position. So, I mean, when I'm breathing based on where I want, on the level in the water I want to be at. So I'll take a deeper breath in sometimes if I want to go up a little bit, and I'll take a deeper breath out if I want to go down a bit more. And I just kind of play with the kind of the tidal volumes that I have in my lungs. And then, prerequisite. If I could give a prerequisite for it, I'll tell you the best people that I've taught diving to have been from like a few professions. So it's interesting. Plumbers or tradesmen, usually very good because they're really good with their hands. And especially I taught one plumber last year. He's one of the first students I ever taught. And he was a Kiwi guy who was moderately athletic, and he knew all the valves that we're using on the tanks and that. So it's just, you're like, all right, do I even need to explain this stuff to you? Obviously, yeah. But it's review for a lot of them. They're like, hey, this is a K valve. Oh, yeah, whatever. I know how this works. But yeah, things like that. That and then nurses are phenomenal divers. I've taught four nurses now, and the amount of, I've learned to really love listening to stories from nurses. You ever want great stories about crazy stuff? Start to befriend nurses. They have some of the funniest stories about just their jobs I've ever heard in my life. But they deal with fear a lot, and they have to drop kind of, they have to be two different people almost, right? When they're on the job, because you have to have that caring, affectionate, empathetic and compassionate approach. But you have to do it kind of almost unemotionally. So you deal with fear and you deal with making, with mindset a lot in that way. And I find that definitely positively translates to, I had a group of four in early February, and the two girls I taught were nurses, and they picked up everything. It's just so fast. And it's just because they don't overthink things. They're not scared of anything. They're very used to being instructed in a clear way. So
learning on your feet almost.
Yeah. It's interesting though. It's funny how you encounter the different things with different people. Also, different countries have different kind of propensities to swim as well. So obviously you have to be able to do, there are some swimming tests you have to do to start an open water course. You can't not be able to swim and try and learn how to scuba dive. But the different countries have different propensities to swim. So, I mean, Scandinavians particularly are all usually good swimmers, all very good swimmers. And you never have trouble. You're never worried about them and their kind of comfort in water at all, because they're all just really, really good at that. That's just one example.
I see. So you don't only deal with people in the water. You also deal with a lot of wildlife, obviously. You wrote down a couple of the coolest animals and fish you've seen underwater. One of the first ones was you saw a cuttlefish orgy.
Oh, it's okay. That's on the list. I've got two things on my list of things I haven't seen.
Oh, okay. So that's what you want to see.
And a cuttlefish orgy is one of them, and a school of hammerheads is the second one. These cuttlefish are they're super promiscuous. It's really, really funny. I've seen videos of like six of them getting it on in their weird little like sentinel way that they do it. And supposedly it's hilarious. So
it's a goal.
There is, I mean, people love dirty nature, right? Dirty nature is really fun to a lot of people. So that's definitely funny. A good example of dirty nature.
What about an electric clam?
Maybe the coolest thing I've ever seen. I was trying to send you a video of it last night. I'll send it to you when I can get it through. Maybe one of the coolest things I've ever seen underwater. So it's a clam. If you could probably search videos of what they look like. It's a clam that literally looks like it has an electrical current pulsing through it. Oh, and when you see it for the first time, you're like, oh my God, what song is he playing? You know?
it looks like a pair of lips.
It looks like a little pair of lips with this little electrical current next to it. Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
What else have you seen? Anything? Any other cool animals that people can Google? Or sorry, fish, I guess?
Mola molas. Those are the weirdest ones. A mola mola is on like everybody's bucket list to see if you're a serious diver. And they're a hard one to see. One of the big spots you see them is in an island called Nusa Penida, just next to Bali. One of the biggest, it's one of the hottest dive spots now in the world. Well, not right now, obviously, but before tourism shut down long term, it was one of the hottest dive spots in the world. Yeah. And they have mola mola season. And these are the most like weird, just absolutely out there looking fish you ever see. Google
looks
it.
It looks like a shark with no ass. Seriously, it looks like a shark cut off in half.
Yeah.
You see it, and the first thing you think is, "What the fuck is this?"
Yeah.
And is this human size? Then I'm seeing in some photos,
it's like they're like twice the size of people. They're huge.
Oh my.
Yeah, the one thing you're not prepared for when you see them is how big they are.
How close are you coming to a mola mola?
Probably 6 feet away.
Holy shit.
Yeah, 6 feet away.
How big is that mouth?
Mouth's not that big. Mouth's okay. No. But it's the fins, man. It's the way that they move. It's so weird the way that they pulse those two fins up and down. You don't know how they still exist. You really don't.
Yeah.
They're crazy, prehistoric looking things. But yeah, definitely bucket list for everybody else. And the big ones you see it in a lot of places are manta rays and whale sharks. We get whale sharks here. I saw my first whale shark in almost a year last week. Wow. So I was pretty fired up about that, if you can imagine. Every time you see a whale shark, there's nothing really compares to that for me. That's the biggest fish in the sea, the biggest thing you can see in the sea. Ones we get here are about between 3 and 6 meters max. The ones you get in Galapagos, maybe not Galapagos, I forget exactly. I know the ones you get in the Philippines and in Honduras and places like that, where they're fully grown, they're like 12, 13 meters. They're massive. They're insane.
Oh my God.
How big they get. And every time you see one, you always remember how big they are and how much weight they're moving around with that tail every day. It's insane. Mantis are beautiful to watch. The other good one too, actually, that you might find weird and interesting is called a thresher shark. You Google that one. There's a place in the Philippines that's famous for the thresher shark spots, and they have thresher sharks are smaller sharks that have these really long wispy tails, and they actually use those tails to they'll whip the tail at their prey to kind of stun them, and then lead them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
Yeah. Well,
if I was in the ghetto of the sea, what would I see?
Oh, the ghetto of the sea. I don't know the best politically correct term for that. What I'm trying to think about is like, if you went into like the characters you see when you see in like a kind of low income housing spot of a city. You know what I mean? Yeah. The people on the street and that they're just different people, right? The equivalent of that underwater is called muck diving, and it's just diving in sand, pretty much off of the shore in a lot of places. And I've got to do some really really cool muck diving in the Philippines and Indonesia. There's some decent muck diving in here, but what you're seeing is a lot smaller things. So different types of sea slugs, different types of shrimps and crabs. One of the big crown jewels of muck diving for everybody is called, things called frogfish, and they change color, and the way that they camouflage is insane. You see cuttlefish, you see crazy different types of shrimp. The best part about it is they're such entertaining dives, because it's just your dive master just finding a rock with a little, there's not really big reefs or anything, it's just little tiny rocks and structures that small creatures have inhabited. And you just dive along the shore, and a sloping downward kind of shelf, and you just kind of go along up and down, and your dive master will find one thing, and you'd be like, oh man, that's cool, and he'll find something else, and it's small stuff, but it's interesting stuff. They call it macro in scuba diving, because macro, I mean, I had a debate with a friend about the term macro used anyway, but it's and macro is the type of lens you would use to see really small things. So they call them muck dive. You're looking for macro, is looking for small stuff.
Okay. Were you always kind of had a passion for animals? Like, I know I saw some pictures of like seeing animals across your different travels. Is that something you, since you were a kid, or is that just something you kind of picked up while you started diving?
Both. I loved animals growing up. I was obsessed with animals growing up. I went to when my grandfather was still alive, we between the ages of 2 and 4, I think he used to take me to the zoo like 2 or 3 times a week in the summer. And so I got to some of my earliest memories are being at the zoo, at the Toronto Zoo, and seeing the animals there. Obviously, I'm not much of a zoo goer these days.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, at the same time, I can appreciate the conservation efforts that places like the Toronto Zoo do. I don't love animals in captivity. It was a really fundamental, important part of my childhood, and I really liked that about it. And it really acquainted me with animals from afar quite early. I didn't grow up with dogs or cats or anything, though. That's kind of something that I've learned over actually living in Koh Tao, because there's dogs and cats everywhere. Like, we have a couple of cats just come into our house and chill, because they're our neighbor's cats. Same with the dogs. Like, the dogs here live like cats. I had a dog. I was taking care of a dog all the way through last year. That was the first time I had kind of my own a pet that I took care of. And I've learned to. I used to hate cats, and I'm still allergic to cats, I think, but. I've been hanging around and socializing with cats lots in the past 5 or so months, and I absolutely love cats now. So Yeah, any opportunity you can to get close to something that isn't human, I think is very important. I know that's a bit of a weird spin on it, but I think I've really learned over the past year, especially the emotional connections you develop with animals and different wildlife, and how and just I there was a point last year where I felt like I said to somebody, I feel like I've learned more from taking care of this dog this year than I've learned from any other human. Seriously.
That's crazy. And you're big into the teaching too. So you taught, you had a chance to teach your stepmother and your brother who came over. So that kind of reminds me of like how you've had a different experience teaching different types of people, whether it be strangers or people, you know. How was that experience?
Yeah. Oh, have you ever taught somebody that you love and loves you a lot how to do something that they're not a little bit uncomfortable with?
It's a hilarious experience.
Yeah. Oh my God. It is so,
you don't want to offend them, fun. Right?
And you don't want to, but it's also just like it's hard for if you're the one learning to let go of the relationship, you know, and see the person as your instructor. It's really, really hilarious. So I actually didn't teach my brother, because we were traveling when he did his open water. I didn't teach his open water, but I dove with him every dive we had in the Philippines after that. So I taught him lots of stuff after that. But I did teach my stepmother how to do, I taught her advanced course. So I certified her to 30 meters. She, did her open water 20 years ago in a quarry in Ontario. And she couldn't remember anything. I was a little bit nervous. So I had her do her little refresher with the skills with somebody else, just because I didn't want that. I wanted, you know, her to have an experience being kind of coming right back into it after 20 years with somebody that wasn't me, so there's a little bit less pressure there. And then I took her for the course and we had a hilarious time. And it is so funny when you like, when you have to teach a person who's nurtured you and is used to caring for you and has so much trouble giving up that control sometimes, you have to commit. And then they get underwater and they realize, oh my God, I know nothing about what I'm doing. And this is the guy that is going to lead me through all of this. You know, not in a bad way, but like I'm sure from her perspective, as soon as you descend down and you realize it's just you and your stepson, and you don't know what you're doing, and it's your stepson that knows what he's doing, you have to give up the trust pretty quickly. It was really, really funny to watch her do that, and to watch her have trouble giving up the trust at some point. And you know, she would try and help me with something underwater, and I'm like, no, stop, don't move.
It's my turn.
I don't need help putting something in my pocket. Okay, it's fine. I can handle this. I'm a big boy. I can do this. But yeah, having to deal with that was so fun. And then especially too, we always had this joke when she would, if my dad was leaving for a weekend or something like that, he was traveling, or he wasn't going to be around for a night, and Maureen was taking care of us, my brother and I. You know, there was always the joke. This joke that they would do with each other, where my dad and her would be like, oh, you know, it's fine, you just have to keep them alive, it's okay, just keep them alive, it's fine. And so then I was waiting for months to say that to Maureen when I found out she was going to come and visit me. And as soon as we went down for the first time, I said, just remember, Maureen, all I have to do is keep you alive, that's all. And how the tables turned that way, it's beautiful.
That's funny. What about JP, the free diving instructor? Did you learn a lot from him, or what's the story around him or her?
Yeah, so I was trying to write down a bunch of little funny little bits of interesting people I've met diving or free diving or scuba diving. Free diving is new to me. It's been something that I've been exposing myself to in kind of a learning sense for the past year, just because I know lots of free divers around the island as well. And there's free diving shops and there's scuba diving shops. Difference between the two is free diving, for those of your listeners who don't know, free diving is breath hold diving. So going to a desired depth on one breath. And the free diving is, I would say, is probably at the pinnacle of all of the physical exercise and sport that I've ever done. I don't think there's something more challenging that you can do, that challenges you physiologically, mindfully, And I mean, in terms of how much it challenges your fear and just trying to find a zone where you're comfortable. And then the also being able to put that all together and connect your how you're what you're doing with your body with how you're feeling in your mind. It's very difficult. But there is a reason that there are people on earth who can hold their breath for 10 minutes. And I think it really shows the power of the human mind and what it's capable of. And I think freediving has been the most paramount experience in my life where I've been able to really, really see that. And it's kind of come at the perfect time as well. But I learned I've just finished my level one. So level one's 20 meters on one, 20 meters deep on one breath. Yeah, it's epic. I'll tell you that, it's epic. Especially too, being an instructor, a scuba diving instructor, it's always, I love being the student again. I love to learn and to see how other people teach different things. So JP, who is the scuba diving instructor or the free diving instructor at the dive shop that I work at, or that I've worked at, my friend Sam and I decided, I've done some technical diving. I've done all of my recreational diving certifications that I can do. The only one left is free diving. Let's have a look. I have ambitions of doing free diving long term as well. But I want to really see how this goes. And so we did it. And JP's a nurse. So like I was saying, when you talk about the lack of fear aspect and the things you see as a nurse, applying that to teaching something that where your body is your engine as well. He does it really effectively, and he's so funny the way he does things. Just to give you one example of just the jokes that go on through the course. For one of the skills, we had to wear this weight around our neck so that your body keeps flat and not tilts up or down when you're underwater. And you had to wear this kind of, it would Velcro around your neck. And he gets it on me, and he gives this big bit about how this is his favorite choking device. He puts it on me, and he goes, "How's it feeling, Matt?" And I was like, "Yeah, it's good." He goes, "Okay, now say my name," and he just started laughing.
And the last thing you want to do before you're about to jump 20 meters underwater.
But that's the thing, is you got to keep things light. You have to keep those things light, especially when like free diving is a lot scarier than scuba diving for a lot of people. I would, definitely. Like, according to JP, says that he certifies 75% of his students that come through the program, meaning that 75% of people that try to do the free diving level one will end up being certified to continue to free dive as a level one free diver. Whereas the certification rate is a lot higher in scuba diving. Like my certification rate is probably, my certification rate is 99% probably. I've had one student that I ended up certifying. I couldn't certify him as a full open water diver because he missed the morning and they were leaving the day after. So that's the only things that, you usually can get a lot of people through. But the thing is just because your body is your equipment in free diving. If your body's not working, you can't, it's hard. You'll have to do it in different stages. Sometimes it takes a lot longer because you get down. And there was one day this week where we had the same thing happen where both of us showed up, started to dive down, and we're just not feeling it. I mean, I hit a big mental wall, couldn't get, and finally got past it. And then my ears stopped working. So different things like that. You always got to roll with the punches.
Yeah. For sure. Is there one certain dive, like, do you find it all just kind of weaves into one, or is there like one dive or one dive trip that you remember that kind of trumps all the rest of them?
Oh yeah. You know what? I would say it does both. It weaves into one. But there's dives that stand out. Like there's a few dives I've had in Koh Tao where, we haven't even seen anything specific, but I get most excited about the diving conditions when all the stars align and you happen to be at the right place at the right time because the wind's been good the past while. The waves have been calm, the sediment settling. It's the nice part of the year when you can hop in the water and you can see for 30 meters in front of you. Like, that is, that to me is the best type of dive. Is my favorite thing about diving is when you walk in and you see this amazing visibility and how clear and blue the water is. It's like the perfect storm, right? It's like the perfect wave if you would relate it to surfing, right? It's finding that perfect wave because you're at the right place at the right time where everything seems to be in balance, and you just get to reap the benefits and be a visitor into the underwater world. It's amazing. But I mean, every dive I've seen a whale shark has been like one of my favorite dives for sure. One of the most surprising dives ever I had was one, like we were talking about, the first time I went muck diving, and I came up and went, oh my God, that was one of the most entertaining, cool dives of my entire life. And I didn't even see anything that was particular. I mean, and most people associate their best dives to seeing big things. And I try and look beyond just seeing big things and seeing what else is going on and kind of the randomness and the, like I said, how the stars can align and you just are in the right place at the right time.
Are there any other kind of diving stories? I tried to touch on all the ones that you brought up to me, but is there anything else that comes to mind or any closing thoughts as we kind of move away from the diving side? Because I know that's your big passion.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to talk about any of the economics of it at all, and trying to live off of a dive instructor salary, it's not super easy. Koh Tao has been the mecca of diving in Southeast Asia for 15 plus years now. And it's slowly, as other dive places like Nusa Lembong and Nusa Penida, Bali, places like that are starting to be up and coming. I think it's taking away a little bit from the dive market here. So they've actually declined over the past few years. The other thing with Koh Tao is there's nearly 100 dive shops, and it's kind of it's going to be interesting to see what happens after the coronavirus. Not even the coronavirus, but the economic recession and what's to come from over the next year or so, how that changes the dive market here, because it's going to change it in a crazy amount. If you have 100 players and there's economic contractions, some of those players are going to be lost. That's the sad reality, is that not all of the dive shops that are closed before the virus are going to open again. It's similar. It's like you've been seeing back home with restaurants and bars and things like that. The turnover, their margins every month are quite short, and a lot of them have quite big costs. And when you mix Western owners with Thai owners too, there's a little bit, some tension can arise in terms of where the money goes, obviously. Sure. But yeah, I mean, overall, the dive market here has been declining over the past couple of years. And I mean, it's sad to watch, because as much as I would love to work somewhere else, I think this is the best place I've seen. And it's got the highest training standards. So if you want to become a pro, if you want to learn how to dive in a really proper way, that's up to the training standards that the organization has set, then this is the best place to do it. It always will be, because it's always breeding professional divers. And that's the best thing it's got. But I'm interested to see what it would be like in 2 years, because I mean, we'll see what happens. But I mean, even down the line, if dive shops, if tourism stabilizes again eventually and there's less dive shops, that should mean that the bigger dive shops like Big Blue, which is the one I'm at, reap the benefits of it, and they stick around, and they're as busy as they were in the booming days of like 2013 to 2017.
So in regards to, you said I can imagine there's a lot of competition. What would you say if somebody's going there and they're trying to pick a dive shop per se? Would it be location, reputation, price, or is it just do people usually plan where they're going before?
Yeah, so it's different, right? It's a backpack model. I mean, different people from different countries and different people from with different decision-making processes do things differently. Like Canadians, I find most Canadian people that I've traveled with or met traveling usually have a plan, like usually have kind of quite a stringent plan. So they usually plan out things in advance. A lot of Europeans have met are way more laissez-faire about the way they travel, and they're just kind of like, oh, I'm going to stay here for as long as I get tired of it, and then I'm going to go to another place. And so you definitely see that in terms of how much longer people will stick around and things like that.
Yeah, that makes sense there. It is kind of crazy. Yeah. With if flights aren't going over there, then, but I guess, and also with the backpack limited, how it will be affected for sure.
Yeah. But I mean, even, and, but if I was going to recommend, I mean, if I was going to give you any recommendation on coming to Koh Tao, I'd say go to Dive at Big Blue. That's the shop that I would always recommend to anybody coming to this island. Because I've been at Big Blue a year now. And I owe probably 60% to 70% of what I've learned in scuba diving to diving at that shop. So, and one of the bigger shops, super fun atmosphere, very modern as well, bit more resort-like, have their own boats, and just teaching, like, I loved teaching at Big Blue versus teaching at other dive shops here. I've always just loved the way that they conduct the program and how high they hold their standards. And we've got, I mean, we're one of the biggest dive shops in Southeast Asia. We've got the number one instructor trainer in the world for SSI, which is the agency we affiliate with.
And we've got him on this podcast.
He's been here a few more years than me, trust me. It's, I mean, I would always recommend that. But I mean, in terms of looking for a dive shop at any place, if this is what I say to my open water students every time is, because you kind of have to give them a little bit after the course, like, here, you're going to be able to dive without me now, but just remember, I'm not there just to kind of fix everything for you. So now that you're competent, I mean, you're comfortable diving, you have to be mindful that things are going to be different in other places and you're going to see different things. But I think there are a few pretty universal standards that I'd always recommend is do your research before about the dive sites and the dive shops you want to go to so you can get the most out of it. I would never dive at a dive shop that doesn't have a supply of oxygen on their boats. That's what every instructor I know here would always recommend that. And I mean, a lot of the times you can walk up to a dive. I've done it so many times where you just walk up to a dive shop. My process in other places when traveling around is to kind of figure out what place seems like they know their stuff the best and what place seems like they got the best offer, right?
Exactly.
In Koh Tao, the prices are fixed, so they're all the same. In other places, sometimes they're less fixed. So you'll pay more for a swanky dive shop than you will for something more low-end backpacker focused.